Google announced this week that they're ending individual sales of the much-celebrated and maligned Google Glass. But wearable tech is not dead. In fact, there's an amazing new vest that has GPS, can call 911, and talk back like Siri. Only it's not for people. It's for service dogs. It's the brainchild of a group called the FIDO Project, headed up by Dr. Melody Jackson. She's director of the Center for Biointerface Research at Georgia Tech. Jackson and her colleagues want to dramatically expand what service dogs can currently do.
I have a colleague who is blind and has a guide dog. And he was on the Georgia Tech campus one day when his dog stopped, as they're trained to do if there's something in their path. Well, he knew that there was nothing that should be in their path, so he pulled out his collapsible cane and he felt around to see if there's something was on the sidewalk. He didn't feel anything, and so he said, "Come on, buddy, let's go." And the dog refused. So he thought, well, maybe he's just being a dog. He gave him a little correction, saying, "Let's go." And the dog said, "All right," and they both stepped into wet cement. So if the dog could have said, "We need to go around something that you can't feel with your cane," it could have saved them a very dangerous and certainly inconvenient situation.
So tell me about the FIDO vest that you've designed. Describe it first.
Well, the FIDO vest, FIDO stands for Facilitating Interactions for Dogs with Occupations. And essentially, we're putting technology to wearable clothing for dogs. So we have sensors that dogs can activate with natural dog abilities, such as holding in the mouth, biting, tugging, or just touching with their nose.
And you have the vest with you in the studio, right?
Absolutely, I do. And I have a little scenario, if you don't mind.
Please.
Medical alert dogs perform vital functions. For example, an epilepsy alert dog will detect, before the person even knows it, that they're about to have a seizure. And what they're trained to do is to push the person up against a wall so that they don't just fall down, that they might slide down the wall. And then once the person is having the seizure and they might be unconscious, the dog licks their face to arouse them. But what if the dog could activate a tug sensor to dial 911 and summon help that might sound like this?
"Excuse me. My owner needs your attention."
Well, yeah. Could you talk about some of the other applications of this? Because situations like search and rescue, there are dogs that work with the police and the military. I got to assume there are a lot of other applications beyond the medical service dogs.
Absolutely. And we keep finding more just about on a daily basis. A scenario that happened about 3 months ago in Georgia, we had a young man, teenager, that was lost in the North Georgia mountains who was on the autism spectrum. And every time the dogs would find him, he would run away. So what happens with the search and rescue dog typically is they'll find the target, then they have to re-find their handler, and then they have to re-find the target again. Well, every time the dogs got close, the young man would run away because he was afraid. But what if the dog could stay with the person that they found, activate a sensor on their vest that would geolocate and send a message to the search and rescue handler that says, "Hey, I found the person, and I'm going to stay with him." Bomb-sniffing dogs have the ability to tell what explosive they have found. So is it C4, which is relatively stable and not going to explode if you bump it? Or is it very volatile substance such as TATP, which pretty much you can breathe on it, it'll explode? The bomb squad probably would like to know that. The dog does know it. And so we're working right now with the Georgia Tech Police to implement some systems that will allow the dogs to tell us exactly what explosive they've found.
Dr. Melody Jackson is the director of the Center for Biointerface Research at Georgia Tech, and she's also the founder of the FIDO Project. Dr. Jackson, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
And today we begin a new round of stories from the NPR Cities Project. It's called How We Live.
Develop it into a world-class city.
Community rising from the ashes.
You had everything you need to live, work, play within walking distance.
Our lawns, our houses, our streets.
We're more unified as people in this community.
In the coming weeks, we'll explore how design of buildings, of whole neighborhoods, affects and shapes our communities.
Today, we'll hear about the attempt to design a rebound in a derelict downtown. It's in Las Vegas.
If we don't create that buzz downtown, we will remain at the status quo. And the status quo, in my opinion, is just not good enough.
In her State of the City address this month, Las Vegas Mayor Carolyn Goodman focused heavily on the need for a downtown revival. And she gave a shout out to a tech billionaire,
my mastermind Tony Hsieh,
for playing a key role in a long list of new openings.
The Bunkhouse Saloon, Zappos made-to-order pop-up shop at the old Western Hotel.
The CEO of Zappos has poured hundreds of millions of dollars into property and startup businesses over the last 3 years in downtown Vegas. For Tony Hsieh, this is part revitalization project, part social experiment. He wants to create a lasting, livable community. But his efforts are not without bumps. NPR's Elise Hu takes us around.
In a lot that used to be a Motel 6, Zappos.com CEO Tony Hsieh has helped create a park.
Kids are having fun and adults are hanging out with each other. And what you're hearing in the background is live music from local bands.
The park's perimeter is lined with shipping containers in bright shades of orange and blue and yellow. About 40 local restaurants, retail shops, and tiny art galleries have opened up inside them. In the middle of the park is the music pavilion and lawn, and a 25-foot-tall Swiss Family Robinson-style treehouse playground.
Have you gone down the slide yet? You should. It's part of the experience of visiting the downtown container park.
The container park is part of a much grander vision called Downtown Project. We've been tracking this since we visited last April. The project's aim? To get more people living and working in this forgotten part of Vegas. Hsieh pledged to pour $350 million from his personal fortune to the area. Downtown Las Vegas is the blighted part of the city, where rooms can rent for $29 a night and bottomless drinks are served in plastic footballs. The much better known Las Vegas Strip is miles away.
What you find on the Strip is really geared towards tourists, and what we're focusing on here is geared towards locals and this sense of community.
He says just as culture is to a company, a community is to a city.
So Vegas traditionally isn't really known as a walking town or city. It's a very car-based culture, and we wanted to help create a place where you had everything you need to live, work, play within walking distance. And so if you look one block that way, there's actually the world's largest functioning fire hydrant attached to the dog park and doggy daycare.
Shay's pointing a few blocks down Fremont Street at the dog-dominated small business started by Kathy Brooks.
Hey, Moxie.
She moved here after closing her tech consulting practice in San Francisco.
If you had asked me a year and a half ago the top 100 places in this world, on this entire planet, where I might consider relocating my life, Las Vegas would not have even been on the list.
But thanks to an investment from Downtown Project funds dedicated to incubating small businesses, Brooks opened up the Hydrant Club. It's a downtown dog park where dogs stay and play for the day while getting behavioral training, too.
Amidst this community rising from the ashes of downtown Las Vegas was a real need for a place for the dog community to be a community.
The Hydrant Club is one of 60 startups and about 800 jobs funded by Hsieh's project. The investments are a mix of tech startups, traditional small businesses like restaurants, and education or health initiatives, all part of creating a community at hyperspeed. The idea is that when people live, shop, and work in the same neighborhood, it fuels chance encounters, collisions, as they call them here, that lead to innovation.
It's impressive. There's a lot of change happening, and it happens almost daily.
That's Matt Heller, a downtown Las Vegas dweller I found at one of the new co-working spaces that's popped up downtown. He used to lead brand development at retailer Abercrombie & Fitch, but now considers himself part of the downtown community. 3 years since Hsieh started spending, Heller wonders what happens beyond this initial cash infusion.
There is zero sustainability in downtown Las Vegas. Zero. We have to keep it growing every day. So the question is, at what cost? And I'm not sure when someone will say, you know what, we can't afford to water this grass anymore. There isn't any income.
Hsieh's company of 1,600 is headquartered here, and there's no sign Zappos is short of income after a $1 billion purchase by Amazon. The downtown project started when Hsieh moved Zappos' permanent headquarters to the old downtown City Hall.
All right, you guys. So welcome to our customer service department. This is our largest group here at our headquarters. So
I took a tour of Zappos, where guides emphasize its focus on customer service. Hsieh actually made his name on creating a company culture where people wanted to work. With Downtown Project, he's doing it at a city-sized scale, trying to create a place that people want to live.
We love to eat here, so that ice cream coming out.
All right, Shay's young staff also needed life outside work, and there was nothing around but dilapidated motels. So the man who focused on company culture started thinking about what cities need in order to thrive. But there are questions now about how the vision's being managed. The project laid off 30 main office staff in the fall. This week, the project's chief spokesperson left her job. The company offered no explanation. And unsettling events have further rattled the community. Among them, two entrepreneurs involved with the project died by suicide. Back at the container park with Shay, he says he's learning as he goes along.
I come from the tech world where you can kind of go from idea to launch in 24 hours. And so even though I knew obviously the physical world can move slower than the tech world, there are just some things that just take a lot of time and therefore a lot of patience.
Shay told NPR this week the project is still on track, but he doesn't claim to have all the answers.
And sometimes there are things that you just might not have ever anticipated just because I'm not from that world.
The investor in Shay is giving this project another 2 years to break even. His Zappos business is based here, after all. But he says he wants to see a city revitalized for more than just a business reason.
I don't know if it needs to be framed as, oh, you're either in business to maximize profits or you're this philanthropic, altruistic person. I think there can be an in-between where you try to do well by doing good, and it's a win-win-win for everyone.
Is it working so far?
I hope so.
A revitalizing urban core built on tens of millions of dollars and a lot of hope. In that way, the project is a lot like the restaurants and retail inside shipping containers here. Is this temporary? Is it permanent? For now, it's a little bit of both in downtown Vegas.
All right, thanks, Tony.
Elise Hu for the NPR Cities Project.
Think of auto shows and concept cars probably come to mind. Remember the cars of the future?
Cars with sensing probes that follow the road with no help from the driver. Cars without steering wheels. Cars without transmissions.
New technology and new styling, that's what concept cars are all about. And after being virtually absent from auto shows for the last few years, concept cars are back with a vengeance. NPR's Sonari Glinton has this report from the big auto show in Detroit.
Car executives, techno music, and crazy new concept cars. It must be January in Detroit.
Ladies and gentlemen, introducing the Chevrolet Bolt EV concept.
Its code name is HCD15, but we call it Hyundai Santa Cruz.
If you could use innovation to build the ultimate Ford performance vehicle, what would it be? Well, here's an idea.
Ah, Detroit, the birthplace of techno music. Anyway, concept cars tell us much more about the current state of the auto industry than the future. All these cars at the show are pretty normal. Bill Visnick from Edmunds.com says it wasn't that long ago that concept cars were just plain whack.
But some of the really wildest of the wild that I remember back then was Chrysler was very big on plastic cars. They were going to make all plastic cars.
I got just one word for you, plastics. Visnick says car companies can be really insular. They can convince themselves that the future is in, say, plastics. But concept cars allow automakers to do test runs before they sink an average of $1 billion into a new car.
And that way, if it falls flat on its face, you can just sort of open the closet and put it in there and never show it again. And there's really no harm, no foul, other than the money that you've spent up to that point to develop it. It's really expensive now to bring a vehicle to production, any kind of vehicle, and then have it fall flat on its face in the market.
Now, car companies have abandoned the really crazy ideas for designs that are much closer to reality. The new concept cars are ones you're more likely to see on the road.
So what we're looking at right now, this is Honda's FCV Concepts, and it showcases the styling evolution.
Angie Nucci is with Honda. She says the companies don't just learn about whether consumers will accept the whole car, but also about the parts that go into them.
I think for a lot of manufacturers, and for Honda too, it's an exercise in figuring out how is everything going to fit together, and also we can gauge some early consumer reactions to the vehicle.
From Honda, now to Buick. I'm
standing in front of a Buick concept, the Avenir, that car geeks here are raving about. It's supposed to show the public what direction Buick is going in. It's a long, low car with a swoop back, and it kind of screams luxury. Michelle Krebs, an analyst with Autotrader.com, says there's a dollars and cents reason for the reemergence of these prototypes and passion projects.
More concept cars and more performance cars and more sexy cars are representative of the booming economy.
Building and moving concept cars from show to show isn't cheap. So when the economy is bad, they're the first thing that gets cut. But Krebs says they can be really vital.
There's ego in it. But the other thing it does is it allows people to be creative. They don't have the constraints of a production car. Designers need to be thinking way out there, and some of it's not ever going to see the light of day, but you want to keep creative forces going.
Krebs says, as silly as some concept cars are or have been, they help make the cars we actually drive better. From the Detroit Auto Show, Sonari Glenton, NPR News.
Wearable technology. Maybe some of you have been trying it out. These are gadgets that collect health information. Everything from how much exercise we're getting to how stressed we are to how many calories we're consuming. The aim of these products is to transform healthcare in much the same way Amazon took on traditional book publishing. So let's hear how doctors are reacting. Here's Amy Standen from member station KQED in San Francisco.
Let's be clear here that Dr. Paul Abramson is no technophobe. There's the hydraulic standing desk from Denmark, and the stethoscope with a data screen.
I'm both an engineer and I'm in healthcare and I like gadgets.
Abramson is a primary care doctor in San Francisco, where he sees patients from the tech industry. And more, he says, people are coming in with data collected from consumer medical devices, sometimes a lot of data.
Everything from heart rate to symptoms to medications to a variety of things.
Like the patient who came in with pages and pages of Excel spreadsheets.
The thought of going through it and trying to analyze it or extract meaning from it was not really feasible.
To Anderson, the spreadsheets just didn't say all that much.
I get information from watching people's body language, from observing their minor tics and their tone of their voice.
Subtleties you just can't get from a Fitbit or some kind of health app. But despite any reluctance on the part of doctors, technology startups are actively trying to insert their products into the doctor's office. Michael Blum, a cardiologist at the University of California, San Francisco, says he gets pitches from entrepreneurs almost daily.
Their perspective is, you know, you old doctors have kept things the same as they are for 50 years. We've got new technology and it's going to disrupt healthcare.
Don't get him wrong here. Blum says healthcare needs a high-tech update, for sure. Doctors can benefit from more granular data about how their patients are doing. The problem is, just because a device looks shiny and new doesn't mean it works. Fitbits and Apple Watches aren't regulated by the FDA.
We can't make the leap that just because this data is coming in digitally, it's accurate. We can't make that leap. We have to do the validation studies.
And often that task falls to doctors and hospitals. At UCSF, Blum now heads an entire new department created to sort out which technologies are game-changing and which are dead ends. And other healthcare groups are following suit. It means running pilot studies, giving devices to people with illnesses, and seeing whether they help.
When I heard that there was a trial that involved a wearable that would help me better manage my symptoms and my condition, I said to myself, well, that's a pretty cool thing. I've got to try that.
Brett Parker, who lives in New York City, has Parkinson's disease. And because there is no cure for Parkinson's, his attitude for a long time was to ignore it.
My feeling was, don't worry about things that you can't control and that aren't affecting you that badly. I'd rather just, in a sense, just live my life and not think about it.
But as his disease has progressed, that's changed. It's become important to pay attention to small details, like are the tremors worse when Parker gets less sleep or eats differently or takes his medicine at a certain time of day? So the pilot study he's taking part in looks at whether a wearable activity tracker made by Intel can answer those kinds of questions by picking up and creating a digital diary of his tremors day and night.
This is going to be a battle between me and the Parkinson's over the years to come. And as it advances, it means I've got to be better and smarter at my role in it. You know, it's one thing to be passive when it's not a big deal. I'm going to have to be more active as the condition gets worse.
The results of this Parkinson's pilot are due later this year. It's one in a slew of studies to see whether consumer health tools will amount to more than just trendy gadgets. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen in San Francisco.
Look over the output of writer, producer, director Michael Mann. You'll find a lot of criminal activity. Films like Heat, The Insider, and Public Enemies. TV shows like Crime Story and, of course, Miami Vice. With his new movie, Black Hat, he's taking on cybercrime.
This is basically a detective story. It's a detective story of what's happening in the brave new world that we live in.
Chris Hemsworth plays Nicholas Hathaway, a brilliant criminal hacker in a maximum security prison. When a cyber attack triggers a nuclear accident in China, Hathaway gets furloughed so he can help solve the crime.
Is he political? Terrorist attack, any declaration?
The guy we're working with dropped the big hammer and not think twice about it.
He's on the move again.
Chicago, now China.
This is only the beginning.
Hathaway teams up with a Chinese army officer, played by Asian-American pop star Lee Hom Wang. There's plenty of space for gun battles and explosions, but the heroes are fighting an invisible villain.
Hathaway has to find and stop an adversary who resides, for the most part, in a virtual world.
We have to talk about the weird timing on this, because I imagine that by November, you've pretty much wrapped up everything on this film. Then the Sony cyber attack happens. What goes through your mind when you're watching the news about that?
We started researching this 2.5 years ago, and the extent of intrusions and the awareness of vulnerabilities to hacking because of the interconnectedness of absolutely everything, we've been tracking it all along, so this was kind of one in a sequence. And since it's our subject, we were kind of familiar with it. What did hit home is that some of these people are my friends that got attacked, so that became very personal.
Hmm. So what was it that initially got you excited about this topic?
Stuxnet happened, and I was very interested in that because it was more than a hack. It's not kind of impersonal, undramatic, just ones and zeros doing things.
Stuxnet was the worm virus that was sent to attack the Iranian nuclear infrastructure.
Exactly. And when I read about how the malware was built, it was a scenario, but a very dramatic scenario, kind of a multi-act play. You know, who's conceiving this? Who's writing it? What kind of people are they? And then in the private sector, who are black hat hackers? What's the high? What's the the elevated experience? And we wanted to do a large-scale kind of crime story, something epic in size, and this was it.
You know, a lot of Asian Americans have complained about wanting to have more Asian male leads that aren't
right.
Stereotypes. And the officer, the Chinese officer in this film, played by Lee Hom Wang, definitely seems to deliver on that. Can you tell us about him? I understand he's a pop star in China.
No, he's not just a pop star in China. He is the biggest pop star in Asia. He's Justin Timberlake of Asia. I had trouble shooting in some locations in Hong Kong because if I panned the camera to the right a little bit, there'd be some block-long, two-story-high billboard of Lee Hom Wang selling Seiko watches. We'd have 1,500 screaming teenagers at 3 o'clock in the morning waiting to see Lee Hom Wang. And Chris Hemsworth laughs about it and told us the anecdote. They're basically pushing Chris Hemsworth out of the way to get to Lee Hom Wang. He's grew up in Rochester, New York. He was 17. He's tremendously, tremendously bright. I love him. He's just a great guy.
Looking over your body of work, I mean, going back to Crime Story and Miami Vice, you know, The Insider. It seems safe to say you have a fascination with illegal activity.
Yeah, well, I like dramatic conflict. I like things in high relief. I like people who are faced with important questions that, you know, they have to make critical decisions.
Is there something about that that just opens up human experience for you somehow? What is it about it?
Well, it's kind of an opportune dramatic structure. Most of us live our lives within the confines of the judicial system we were born into, the political economy we were born into. A criminal, by self-definition, is outside social mores and values. So that puts him into conflicts that he has to struggle to manage, to maintain his existence. And if I can bring an audience into some empathetic relationship where we're invested in them and we see them in an internalized kind of a way.
I want to finally take you very far back, because I came across a line in a piece about you where it said that you
As a young man, you moved to London after discovering Stanley Kubrick, the great director of 2001, Dr. Strangelove, Clockwork Orange, you know, many great, great films. I was just curious about that. What was it about Kubrick that caught your imagination?
You know, I saw Dr. Strangelove in 1963 when I was in Madison, Wisconsin, where I was an undergraduate. And it was a revelation. What struck me is that it was possible to make a film as a real auteur for a mass audience.
For people who haven't seen it, I should say that you were so inspired by a dark, dark, dark comedy about nuclear holocaust.
Right. It's something that I quite still haven't figured out, which is why that film passed the test of time. I don't know how many times I've seen Strangelove, but it's as fresh and exciting today as it was, you know, 1963.
Could you see yourself making something in that vein? What would be the black comedy that Michael Mann would make?
Oh, boy. Okay. I don't know. We would really have to... That's a very good question.
Michael Mann's latest film is Black Hat. It's out right now. Michael Mann, thanks very much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Pleasure being here.
Americans increasingly see reliably fast internet as being a utility, more like a functioning sewer line than a luxury. A number of cities are trying to get into the internet provider business, but laws in 19 states hamper that. President Obama announced this week that he wants to lift those restrictions, and supporters of what's known as municipal broadband can't wait. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
While President Obama talked in Iowa about municipal broadband, an auditorium full of people in Kansas City, attending something called the Gigabit City Summit, cheered him on.
Leaders from 50 cities and towns across the country. It's a coalition called Next Century Cities.
It's a coalition promoting high-speed internet. Its director, Deb Socha, says fast, dependable broadband has become a social justice issue.
This is about people. And people in communities who need resources for businesses, for e-government, for participatory democracy, for healthcare, for transportation, for education. Everything we do is related to our access to technology.
Anyone who's ever died a little waiting for a page to load or a stalled movie to resume wants faster internet. But major internet service providers don't face much competition in many places, so they're not that motivated to upgrade. Faced with that, some towns have gotten into the internet service business themselves. Mike Klein works for one of them, Chanute, Kansas.
They started their municipal electric utility over a century ago, long before we had computers and toasters and microwave ovens, on the faith that this electricity thing was going to be important to the local economy. Well, today the city fathers have that same vision about this broadband network.
Chanute's broadband network runs about 100 times faster than typical American internet. Klein says it's given his remote Kansas town one of the fastest-growing junior colleges in the country and connected its hospital in high def to distant specialists. Klein, who's an engineer, says all this was feasible because Chanute already ran its own electric utility.
They already have line workers. They already have the utility poles, the rights of way. The infrastructure is largely in place.
But the cable industry has a warning for towns that don't have that ready-made infrastructure, says Brian Dietz with the National Cable and Telecommunications Association.
So there's been several examples where government-run networks have failed because they aren't able to compete effectively with private-run networks.
Dietz points to Provo, Utah, which spent more than $39 million building a fiber network. The system lost money, and the city wound up selling it to Google for $1. Dietz says internet service providers have invested more than $230 billion nationwide building networks. They've also been pretty successful at convincing state legislators that taxpayer-funded municipal broadband is a bad idea. 19 states now prohibit or at least discourage public involvement in the broadband business.
We've got the largest citywide robust gigabit network in the country.
Ken Hayes works with Chattanooga, Tennessee's 600-square-mile gigabit network. The city built it on its publicly owned electric utility, same as Chanute. And Chattanooga wants to expand service to outlying areas where internet speeds plunge, but it ran into one of those prohibitive state laws.
Our electric utility actually petitioned the FCC along with Wilson, North Carolina, to ask the FCC to use their authority to override the legislatures.
That's what President Obama wants in all 19 states. But internet service providers and some Republican members of Congress say the commission has no authority to meddle in the way states regulate the internet. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.